Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 131, where we discuss Rosabeth Moss Kanter's 1972 book, Commitment and Community, Communes and Utopias in Sociological Perspective, published by Harvard University Press. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, I'm Catherine calling from the Midlands of England.
And this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
And this is Sam calling from Lisbon in Portugal. And today we're going to be talking and discussing the book by Rosabeth Moss Kanter entitled Commitment and Community, Communes and Utopias in Sociological Perspective. So maybe let's say something a little bit about the author before through the general description of the book. So Rosabeth Moss Kanter is Ernest L. Arbuckle Professor of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. And I think she's one of the most impressive scholars that we have covered in this podcast. She has written important seminal work across sociology and management studies on issues like organizational commitment, leadership, feminist management theory, work-life balance, strategy and organizational change and innovation. She has published many, many books. Among them, I'll mention just my kind of three favorites, Men and Women of the Corporation, Work and Family in the United States, A Critical Review and Policy Agenda, and then the book that we're going to be discussing today, Commitment and Community, Communes and Utopias in Sociological Perspective. So this book was published in 1972 by Harvard University Press. It is based on Kanter's PhD dissertation on utopian communities and communal living, and in particular in her study of 19th century utopian communities founded in the United States between the Revolutionary and the Civil Wars, so between 1780 and 1860. So Kanter's interest in utopian communities began, as she describes, as a desire to learn about alternatives to established society. And she was likely inspired by the revived interest in communes in the 1960s. She describes utopia as an imaginary society in which humankind's deepest yearnings, noblest dreams, and highest aspirations come to fulfillment, where all physical, social, and spiritual forces work together in harmony to permit the attainment of everything people find necessary and desirable. Utopian communities are social orders that are self-created and self-chosen using commitment rather than coercion. And despite this beautiful description, Kanter acknowledges that utopian communities require a strict social order and a high level of control to ensure that the community actually survives and is able to provide its members with all that is necessary and desirable. Therefore, in this book, Kanter focuses on the problem and the puzzle of commitment as central to the survival and success of utopian communities. And perhaps, as we're going to be discussing, important for the survival and success of any organization to different levels. The problem of commitment deals with how people arrange to do the work. Here I'm citing Kanter, how people arrange to do the work that the community needs to survive as a group and how the group in turn manages to satisfy and involve its members over a long period of time. So this book uses data collected, archival data mainly, on 30 utopian communities, including 9 successful ones and 21 unsuccessful ones. The successful communities that Kanter looks at lasted between 33 and 184 years, and the unsuccessful ones between 6 months and 15 years. So Kanter analyzes this data. She develops a theory on commitment, identifies 6 processes that communal groups use to build commitment, and for each of these processes, she also specifies mechanisms. Last thing is that Kanter's book on commitment, I think we should say, is kind of fits into the wider interest around that topic during that time, so late 70s, early 80s. But her work stands out for being the first one and the only one, I believe, to propose a full theory of commitment, specifying its processes, mechanisms, and the importance for organizational success and survival. And the three aspects of commitment that she discusses, continuance, cohesion, and control, are the ones that continue to be used today in the literature on organizational behavior to measure and understand commitment in organizations.
All right, thanks, Sam. And I'll build a bridge from that to some of our previous episodes. This is our second one on Rosabeth Moss Kanter's materials. So the first one we did was specifically about tokenism, and that was back in episode 17. It was one of our earliest episodes, and we always knew, like several other authors who we've revisited over the years, we've always known that we would come back to Kanter because of her tremendous influence and such an outstanding career. So it's great to bring her back. Also, we covered kind of like the aftermath in some episodes about organizational commitment. Specifically, we covered the tripartite model of organization commitment, which was, I think it was about 5 or 6 years after this book was published. Not sure exactly where the connection is, but I think that she was referenced in some of that work. So this is kind of like even stepping back into the precursors of that particular theory. And I'm sure there are other past episodes that will come to mind as we go on with the conversation.
Sorry, I think her work was discussed as well as part of the live Academy of Management PGW.
Yes.
As well, there was that episode as well. That's how I first came across her, actually. I hadn't listened to the episode on tokenism then. But it's an amazing book and very much of its time, I think, in 1972. And for me, it whet my appetite to see what happened afterwards and what has happened since with communes as well. I don't know if we want to dive straight into the three types of commitment mechanisms at this stage, or how do you want to take it?
I think we got to start with the background, you know, the first chapter on utopia. It's really hard to talk, I think, about much of the content of the book without understanding the central role that the concept of utopia played in why a lot of these communes came to be in the first place. Because it's utopia, we all kind of know what it means, but this is one of those terms that a lot of people have different ideas about. So I think it's worth kind of going, you know, starting with that. I've got it open to page 3, which is a place where she talks about utopian communities as a mechanism for critiquing society, as Sam talked about, such as religious, political, economic, and psychosocial. And the earliest communes in the United States did, quite a number of them were religious in nature. So you had religious groups who decided to break away. Either they broke away because of persecution overseas, came here and set up their paradise, or they broke away from dominant groups here. And I think it's useful to look at how she describes some of the factors or some of the themes, such as, like in this particular case, there's a general theme of the ideal pursuit of a sense of perfection, such that like the current dominant mode in society was in some way poisonous, sinful, unjust, unhealthy, or words she used. And so by creating this commune, they pursue perfection and they're going to be off and isolate themselves-ish from society and set up their own perfect little world.
And it's interesting that that's something, obviously she studied this for many years, but that she got quite engaged with herself and she got involved in the Cumbridge community, you know, which was focusing on perfectionism. And it was something that she was very involved in over the years herself as well. So, you know, it was a real life case study for her. There's a journey that she definitely was on, both academically and personally and spiritually, I think, through this process, as something that she went on to take with her as she traveled work-wise.
Yeah, I think this idea that you've both highlighted of this quest for perfectionism or for perfection is really important, because it speaks to, I think, both kind of the idealism and the beauty, in a way, of the project that utopias represent, kind of the best of humanity, right? She writes, underlying the vision of utopia is the assumption that harmony, cooperation, mutuality of interest are natural to human existence, rather than conflict, competition, and exploitation, which arise only in imperfect societies. But at the same time, we all know, or I hope we all know by now, that with this idea of perfectionism also comes kind of a lot of, right? Like it's a high demand. It never works. It's not realistic in many ways. And especially when we think about this ideal of perfectionism as kind of a collective endeavor, it's going to lead to all kinds of darker behavior, conflict, control, right? All the things that we also associate as kind of the dark side of organizations, all for the sake of perfectionism. So I think it's a perfect concept to try and start discussing this kind of embedded puzzle or problem or challenge that actually organizing and realizing a utopian community is going to involve.
It's also naively optimistic, perhaps, of human beings that perfection could even be possible. So it's interesting of its time as well that people were challenging the prevailing culture in society and the norms of society and the structures of society and wanted to reinvent things, whether it was from Victorian times when a lot of the utopian communes that started, which is a term, of course, she gave them, but people came from England for religious reasons and set up colonies in the US. But even in right into the kind of 60s, which would have been her own time, I guess, experiencing them personally herself, there was a real naive optimism that there was a better way. And it's interesting how that's quite cyclical in times as well. And be interesting to see nowadays, and maybe we can put a kind of modern day lens on it later on, see, you know, what the appetite is for utopian communes at the moment.
I think there is also sort of an important theme of choice, which I don't know that Cantor says explicitly, but like when we look at some of the groups that she's talking about, I mean, obviously persecuted folks or folks who are actively rejected by society in a way didn't really have a choice. What they chose to do was cope in a particular way, but they definitely had to get out of the situation in which they were in. And I guess the different types which he mentions, the psychosocial, the economic, and the religious, all kind of share that. I mean, there you have a group that has decided that it has either been actively ostracized or sees itself as ostracized. And so they separate, they go off in this way. What manifests differently, perhaps, are the justifications, but the justification pursuit of perfectibility. You know, and she covers these themes pretty well in the second chapter. Like, what does perfectibility mean and what are its eventual downsides and how did it manifest? It is one of those things where some of these groups just simply show up in a location to set up a commune. They may have a common idea that they want to get away from a bad situation. And then it's kind of like, well, now what? Which she'll come to describe as a particular class of commune that has a tendency not to succeed. Then later in the chapter is order and sense of brotherhood. I mean, these are utopian values that were shared to varying degrees. A utopian value of order, for example, is trying to establish order away from chaos. Like if it wasn't that the society was imperfect, the society was seen as chaotic, and we're going to impose a self-imposed order by which we have a society that is better functioning. And then so the chapter goes on with those sorts of values.
Yes, I think we're already seeing so many connections to so many different contemporary literatures and organizations, right? Like I think it has a strong connection to value-driven and mission-driven organizations. Just, you know, when Cantor is discussing all these ideas on order as well.
I thought it was interesting that the communes that had a very strong drive and commitment to serve society tended to be the most successful. They tended to have strong boundaries as well. And that the ones where people had to retreat from society were actually the least successful. In some ways, it was kind of a little bit like a guide of how to become a cult leader as well. It's like, or how to become arguably a cultish corporate leader. You know, these are the things you should do and the things you shouldn't do. And really interesting, something that I hadn't considered in advance of reading this book was the importance of financial sustainability. Obviously, it makes sense that you need to be financially sustainable to survive. But, you know, rarely is that actually talked about in terms of utopian communes. It's seen as taboo, or we're so busy kind of perfecting ourselves that we don't want to talk about it. But utopian communes that are successful and have longevity are businesses that are run well and that are sustainable over a long period of time. Again, you know, a lot of correlations with perhaps companies and corporate life as well. And I just, you know, the focus is very much on niche in the sense that these communes didn't become beyond communes and adopted by wider society. Yeah, that the most successful of them didn't rely on ideology alone, and resulted from kind of sociological engineering, which again is kind of fascinating. And there's lots of kind of lessons and pitfalls to that. So the ones that really endured the longest were the Shakers, which before reading it again, you know, my knowledge of the Shaker community was limited, sadly, to movies rather than having any great understanding of them. I think we all know the one I'm thinking about. And the Oneida community, which I didn't know that much about, which again became evolved actually out of a commune into a successful corporate business, which I'm not quite sure, but I think it does still exist today, and the Hutterites. And the least successful one was Brook Farm, which was an agriculturally based one, obviously, as the name suggests, which really didn't survive for all the reasons listed, but mainly because of its inability to be financially sustainable, as well as lacking in other commitment mechanisms. But none of them were so successful, and this is what I was trying to get to there, and I lost my train of thought, that they never graduated beyond their niche, really, and were adopted by wider society. Some, obviously, like the Bruderhof and others, gained thousands of members, or perhaps had international colonies, as they're described, but it was never adopted by wider society. And you know, perhaps that is the point in itself. It's never meant to be something that's generalized or taken on by wider society, but that sense of perfectionism and utopia can only ever be within a very boundaried community, because it's very hard to apply perfectionism once that commune gets beyond a certain size.
Yeah, I think more than perfectionism, I think it's just the limits of organizing, right? And that's really why I love this book is, as you said, we think about utopian communities, and we think about all kind of the values, ideals that are associated with it. Even when we think about organizational commitment, I think I'm kind of already getting ahead of myself of what my critique of the current literature is, but it's so focused on like the individual, right? Like measuring like individual attitudes. Whereas the whole argument in Cantor's book, both about commitment in general and in particular in the case of utopian communities, it's that it's all about organization.
Yeah.
Right? It's how well, I think more than the kind of business model side of it, it's more that it's well organized, and having a good business model is part of that organization, and like so are all of the other mechanisms that she describes. Again, I love this book because of its very kind of profound reflections on human nature and on like very basic key dilemmas that I think are relevant for any kind of organization, right?
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting how, you know, maybe that's part of the other theories that she evolved, like tokenism as well. She wanted to draw attention away from the individual's experience of that to the structural, and yes, you know, that focused her as well in later works.
Well, one thing I want to unpack a little bit, though, and I know that she critiques herself later in the book, but it's the very meaning of success. Sam, you mentioned that, you know, this is a book about organizing as well as an understanding of commitment in the communes. And I did take away that there was a sense of the life cycle of an organization is sort of embedded in here. Now, when we think about an unsuccessful community, or ones that she identified as unsuccessful, 6 months to 15 years. So it's largely time-based. And I'd say that that covers a rather wide range of unsuccess. Because there's something to be said about an organization that lasts 15 years. But, you know, okay, so that's what she drew the line. But it's very clear that in those cases that the values, the utopian values, were all pretty consistent across all the unsuccessful cases. It was the inability to then take that next step to adopt to a higher level of organization by which the commune self-sustains. And that came to, you know, several reasons, which what's already been mentioned about the initial motivation and the extent to which the commune reintegrates or manages the boundary between itself and the greater society, not unlike other types of organizations. But I did find it interesting that success as largely a measure of time.
Yes, we should say that in her analysis of the data, just so that listeners take this into account, it's, she does explain in the appendix, it's basically these the 30 organizations that she chooses at the end is has mostly to do with the availability of data, because of course she's studying organizations from the past. But yes, you're right. It's, I was also curious as to, it's such a big range of time, right? But I guess in terms of the project and the aspirations of these types of organizations, I didn't have a huge problem with how she's deciding to classify them based on how long they lasted.
Well, she also did admit that, you know, as sort of like an open, unanswered question, you know, a question for future research, a commune that served its purpose and then disbanded could very well have been truly successful. It just, this is no longer there, then okay, it's achieved its life cycle. But she didn't actually, she just posed that as a question. She didn't actually use it.
Yeah, yeah. And to kind of be my personal opinion, I use Cantor's whole theory on commitment to analyze a success case of commitment in an organization that lasted 4 months because it was meant to last 4 months. And you kind of observe, you know, all the mechanisms that she talks about in the book, you observe in that organization. So yes, I think time is relative to, of course, the goals of the organization. But I think in this case, because these organizations, you know, had the goal of kind of persisting over a very long period of time, then yeah, it makes sense to classify them as such, I guess.
Yeah. Now, what I like to do, I want to go ahead and highlight the other two values out of chapter two and set, you know, provide the full context of, you know, what are the idealized about commune life? We mentioned perfectibility. We're breaking away because society's imperfect. We want to establish a perfect society. Order, there's chaos in society. We want to establish order. And so then the commune establishes its own rules, its own sense of order, and tends to be rather total. I mean, it's very much everybody, it's supposed to apply to everybody. There becomes questions about differences of rules between leaders and members and stuff like that, but let's just set that aside. Third utopian value is brotherhood. And this is where there's a sense of disharmony in society and the commune seeks harmony. Obviously, in religious, that's a very, very simple thing to understand because religion tends to be very, very collective in its nature. And if you have a quote-unquote brotherhood that of like-minded believers, then, you know, they establish a tight bond, tight network within the commune, which should shield it from outside influence. And then finally, the fourth one was the unity of body and mind, which I sensed that this was a little bit more variant among the communes when they were established. But I'll just read what she had on page 49. Harmony as a utopian value has a meaning, the merging of values, ideas, and spiritual matters with physical events, the union of mind and body, spirit and flesh. I sense that this was more of the psychosocial type of communes that were more dominant in this as their value. Oh, yeah. And there was one more. I'm sorry. With experimentation. These the utopians were very much about experimentation. Like when you establish such of a commune, especially if you're rebuking larger society, then your tendency is to want to try things and to learn, if that is how the commune ultimately decides to behave, to learn and experiment and try its own way until it finds its what it exactly it is its means of perfection or description of perfection and order. So those are all of the idealizations.
Yep, we're missing one.
Yeah, go ahead.
We're just missing coherence as a group. Cantor writes, utopians value their own uniqueness and coherence as a group. Members of utopias are highly conscious of themselves as a community and of their role in history. They have a clear sense of their own boundaries, how far their land extends, who belongs and who does not. So I think this is idea of, you know, it's membership, which of course we know it's very important for organizations, but it's also kind of taking, as we're assuming responsibility for the general behavior and kind of identity or representation of the group as a whole.
Mm-hmm. And I think the importance of understanding these values is that they establish the various justifications and narratives associated with deciding, okay, why are we establishing this commune? And then determining, okay, who are we going to let in? So what are the things that new members, like what's the hurdle that new members have to cross over? What's the rite of passage? And as she talks about some of the rites that emerge out of some of these values, you know, some of them are, I suppose we would say would be constructive. Like, for example, to provide order would be beneficial to all of its members. But then some of these communes then went off also to go to have different or alternative sexual relationships, use of drugs, some of the other things that looked upon from society as extremely deviant, which also served to strengthen the boundary between the commune and society, which the commune in such cases may have been quite happy with.
I think an interesting way in which to think about it as well is in how the groups referenced or viewed themselves as well, and how important it was and how they, you know, how they conceived of that communal life, and they were told how they should conceive of it via the written and unwritten rules, I think, rather than the realities of building that group. It always seems to be reinforced that this is how the group is, rather than you get the impression that it's building it up from the grassroots. I think that's an interesting aspect of the groups as well, and their relationship with reality, which you're kind of touching on there, Tom, which in a lot of them seem to evolve, as you say, over time to suit perhaps the group or a leader. Maybe we'll talk about leadership later on, because for me, that was a little bit missing from the book. Most of us know about utopian communes that didn't work out. It's usually to do with the ego of the leader. And it's interesting that, you know, maybe I missed it, but in the commitment mechanisms, there isn't, I guess, an adherence to there being a leader or somebody who, you know, whether it's a group, a communal leadership, or a leader that you adhere to and follow their rules. Ultimately, all of them, as far as I could see, had leadership. Certainly the most successful ones did.
Actually, that I think that you just touched on something that I love about the book. I think we have an obsession with leadership. And in particular, as you said, like you think about utopian communes, you think about these leaders very often not very nice, successful stories around
them.
But I think that's, you know, because the book is about maybe not how these communes emerged or are born or how they gather enough support to kind of begin organizing themselves, but actually about how they organize themselves over a long period of time and how those mechanisms and processes of organizations actually is what explains their long-term success and survival. And so when you look at that, when that's the story, then leadership, I think, does not matter as much in the sense of, like, specifically if we're thinking about like charismatic leadership and like one particular leader who might be there at some point in time, but is not, right? Like having one charismatic leader is not really enough to ensure that there's a big group or a big system of people like working in the way that it's supposed to be working, that each one of these individuals achieves that balance that Kendra talks about between what they bring to the organization, what the organization brings to them.
Yeah, it's interesting, like, because the most successful ones were the ones, as you say, where the organizing happened organically and the leadership is secondary to it.
Which is in a nutshell, what is
it's not mainstream.
What explains like the failure of so many of the current social movements, right?
It's, yeah.
The obsession with this like one big personality.
Yes.
Not enough like thought goes into how we organize this sustainably. But
Yeah,
I agree. The commitment mechanisms, I mean, she makes that very much front and center, because yes, indeed, we did see a rather wide range of leadership structures, and that a number of these communes, they weren't necessarily leadershipless. What they were was that the leadership was shared, widely shared, And they relied much more on these commitment mechanisms, which included rituals, investments, procedures that enforced a sense of communion, a commitment to the group over self as central. And there, you know, it didn't matter whether it was a single leader or a shared distributed leadership, the rituals and the communion and these other mechanisms that were included. And she lists like a ton of them in the middle. And also like the processes by which individuals effectively deny themselves in order to join the group was far more important to be accepted in that the it wasn't a function necessarily of a single leader. It was a function of the group, how the group welcomed new members, how they incorporated new members, how they enforced their values on existing members. And only when those mechanisms started to break down and were less successful did we see that the commune would start to break up and dissipate.
Okay, so the organizational problem, I guess we could call it, that Cantor centers on in this book is the problem of commitment, as she calls it. So she kind of does a really good job of setting up, I think, this problem or this puzzle for organizations. So from going to kind of all the ideals that inform utopian communities to starting to hint about some of the tensions and challenges of actually taking these ideals into practice, and then focusing on the issue that really what you need for these ideals to be enacted, to be realized, is people being willing to do the work, right? To stay in the organization. I think she talks about like who's going to take out the trash and right. So like all of these very practical day-to-day issues that need to be solved constantly in order for the organization to actually pursue its goals. So she talks about commitment, spends quite a few pages, I think, pulling apart the problem and the dimensions of this problem. Specifically, she focuses on what she calls three major aspects of the social system that involve commitment: the retention of members, group cohesiveness, and social control. So she then translates these major aspects to... So this is where I love this part, but I think she also introduces like different concepts all the time to talk about the same thing. So I think it can get a little bit confusing. But she talks about, she summarizes these retention of members, group cohesiveness, and social control as continuance, cohesion, and control problems, which she also calls, I think at some point, mechanisms, right?
Yeah.
Three types of mechanisms, that's right. Yeah. Or three processes, also she calls them at some point. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's different elements to the types of commitment mechanisms, isn't there? So the continuance one, she talks about sacrifice and having to leave something to develop that commitment. So whether it's personal property or jobs or family, that you're actually leaving something to and sacrificing something as part of that commitment. And the other element, I guess, of that as well is investment. So economically, you're invested in it, or in terms of your time and your energy, you're invested in it, which makes it very difficult to leave, because the longer you are involved in an organization and the more you've invested in it on every level, socially, psychologically, economically, spiritually, the harder it is to leave. So that's another mechanism, that investment mechanism. And then the cohesion mechanism is all about belonging, I guess. So it's more the emotional and the social belonging that you have to that organization, to the commune. And she talks about renunciation, and that is perhaps renouncing everything outside of the commune as part of your commitment, that you make a commitment to the commune as the best way forward, I suppose, for your life and for your work. And then communion with the commune is important as well. And sometimes there's different rituals around that. And I guess some of them can be social, some of them can be around identity that deepen your commitment to the commune. And then in the third commitment mechanism, which is very much about adherence and control, it's about adhering to the norms and the values of the commune. So through mortification, so reducing your ego. And that can be through perhaps having a very simple uniform. If we think of, you know, the simplicity of the Quaker dress, And there's plenty of other examples of that. And to a certain level as well of surrender. A lot of the literature, just a little bit that I know of in some utopian communes that is read by people, there is an element of surrender, whether it's to a god or to the group or to a higher power or to something else. So that collective surrender is also a means of control. So I guess there are the different elements of the commitment mechanism, which ensures that the utopian commune, you know, if all those commitment mechanisms and those elements are met, that it endures for the longest time possible.
Yeah. And also in there was a sense of confession, which was a different way of enforcing the rules. Mechanisms that encourage individuals to own up to their mistakes, as opposed to it all being sort of top-down punishments, although there was certainly that. And that's, and I found that interesting because when we get into part two, I'll talk about confessions of a different sort later. But the idea of imposed humility, it's the phrase that comes to mind, although I'm sure that may not be the most accurate way of putting it. But a sense that everybody in these communes, there's a sense that everybody should be adhering to the same sets of rules. And the more that you saw the emergence of fracturing between individuals, where some individuals are more equal than others, invoking Animal Farm here, then you would start to see other aspects of this group cohesion start to break apart. But those mortification mechanisms were really important to get people to distance themselves individually from society in order to prepare themselves to join and stay. That was the theory anyway.
Yes, I think something that maybe is important to mention of why, you know, why these six mechanisms and why they are successful in ensuring people's loyalty and desire to remain in the organization over a long period of time is because the way Cantor explains commitment, I think it's really beautiful because it speaks about a two-way relationship between the collective or the organization and the individual. So it's about both kind of getting what they need in this perfect balance that needs to be maintained continuously so that people actually stay in organizations and organizations actually remain functional and effective to a certain point. And these six mechanisms emerge out of a kind of match that exists between the three major aspects or challenges of social systems that we mentioned. So the retention of members, group cohesiveness, and social control, which she summarizes as continuance, cohesion, and control. But also she talks about people having three types of orientations towards the social system. So we have an instrumental orientation, an effective orientation, and a moral orientation. And then she matches these, right? So basically, the social system's need for continuance matches with our kind of orientation for being instrumental, basically. What it is that we get out of our participation in the social system, then the social system's need for group cohesiveness matches with our orientation for affect. And then the social system's need for control matches with our orientation towards morality and, yeah, moral issues. And I think another thing that I find really interesting when we think about these three types or processes of commitment that match people with the organization as well as, you know, she mentioned some of these might be more important than others at different times or for different organizations or for different people, right? So thinking about very concrete examples, we might decide to stay in an organization because, you know, maybe we don't have a good income or salary or benefits that come out of it, or maybe we don't believe necessarily on the mission of the organization, but we have very strong bonds with the people that are in it, right? Or maybe it's one of the others. So I think it's also interesting to understand the kind of dynamism of commitment, that it doesn't have to be this like perfect thing all the time, or that it's necessarily static, but it's something more that is continuously changing and needs to be continuously maintained as well. As I think it's important.
Yeah, and I'll piggyback on that because I opened to chapter 6, which got into some of the problems that these communes had as a direct result of their longevity. So, and I think this sort of cements that point we made earlier about how this book is reflective of the maturation process of an organization. That once you get past the initial honeymoon period, that is, you know, when the communes establish, the rules emerge, and they figure things out, then new problems come in once you start welcoming in second generation members, like you start expanding membership. Other problems come in, such as disasters. And that's where she opened the chapter, is that at some point, most of these communes had to overcome some sort of a disaster, whether it was of an internal form, such as a fire or something that damages the property or whatever, that they basically had to they had to weather that storm. Or if it was something extrinsic, where society starts to actively pursue and persecute the commune, which becomes, you know, a make or break point for the commune. And the successful ones, they tended to be strong enough where they could overcome these disasters without splintering or without breaking apart, whereas others just fell apart at the first sign of trouble. So I thought that was interesting. But also, just the second generation, as you get in new people, even though they may be totally wedded initially to the commune, the folks who come in later tend to become a source of tension, and that could break apart the organization after its initial successful phase, which perhaps is why maybe some communes have lasted for 10 years or more, but then all of a sudden dissipated as new people deviated from or challenged the previous structure, and then it fell apart.
Yeah, so perhaps the leadership is not a central issue in this book, and I think that's a good thing. But I think at the same time, this whole theory and observations and the lessons that she's trying to draw from all these organizations are something that is key to leadership. This idea of you always need to be thinking about these three challenges or three dimensions of commitment, and to make sure that even as you welcome new members, you're still, you know, all of those three things are still as strong as they can be throughout time. Yeah.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.